Hi, I'm Kristen.
And I'm her little brother, William.
We're from the podcast Guide to the Unknown, where we only talk about scary stuff and have a good time doing it.
Come join the scary fun, everyone.
Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find Guide to the Unknown.
Greetings and salutations. You've successfully arrived at the Bloody Disgusting Network. The passage of time will now bring you to something strange, unique, and idiosyncratic. Have a good time.
Hey everyone, Randall here. I just want to tell you that today's episode is a relic from the summer of 2020, aka our controversial Nightmares and Dreamscapes era. This episode, a deep dive into TNT's Nightmares and Dreamscapes TV anthology series, was previously available only to our patrons over in the Barrens. We're unlocking it because it features discussion of a few Everything's Eventual adaptations, including The Road Virus Heads North and Autopsy Room 4. If you haven't listened to our Everything's Eventual story ranking, well, it spans two episodes, and they're both there just a few notches down in your podcast feed. A reminder that next month's book in our chronological reread is From a Buick 8, and also that in September we'll have a patron-exclusive episode on King's upcoming book, Fairy Tale, due out in September. As always, the book episodes in our chronological reread remain free. New books can be found in the Barrens. If you'd like to join us in the Barrens, you can get there via Patreon, patreon.com/thebarrens, and check out our tiers. We've got hundreds of hours of content there that is not hyperbole, including our Dark Tower Detour series, our Stranger Things spinoff, Talkin' Hawkins, and the archives, where we unpack the rarities in King's massive catalog. And that's just scratching the surface. So yeah, patreon.com/thebarrens. Enjoy the episode.
He brought you the Green Mile, the Shawshank Redemption, and the Shining. Now, from the incredible mind of Stephen King, journey to a place where reality stops.
It's like the town in the Twilight Zone.
And imagination begins. Eight mind-bending stories. A four-week television event.
I won't do another stretch. You get out this time, you stay out.
Don't make me do it!
4 hours ago, I killed my brother.
If you think your dreams are disturbing, imagine the nightmares of Stephen King.
What are you, some sort of a horror movie guy?
Nope, Clyde, I'm a literary guy.
Nightmares and Dreamscapes from the stories of Stephen King. July, only on TNT.
My friendship to all of you precludes my involvement with any one of you. But if you wanna make love, then I do too, and I'll be right there behind you. All in the name of hope. All in the name of hope. All in the name of
constant listeners, and welcome yet again to the Losers Club, a Stephen King podcast. Well, this is a special episode for Patreon members, and to help gear you guys up for our two-part series on Nightmares and Dreamscapes, the book, we are going to talk about the little curio that is 2006's TNT miniseries, Nightmares and Dreamscapes from the Stories of Stephen King. This was an 8-episode anthology that aired across 4 weeks in the summer of 2006. 8 episodes, 2 episodes aired each night. Each one was an hour long, and they were all based on short stories from mostly Nightmares and Dreamscapes, but also Everything's Eventual and Night Shift. So before we get into all of that, let's go around and introduce ourselves. Who is joining me here in Chicago?
This is Michael, Mr. John Hurt Rothman.
And I'm reporting live.
Wait, John Hurt? Did you John say
Hurt.
John
no,
Hurt?
No, not John Hurt. It's William Hurt. I already messed
it up. Yeah, I was going to say.
You know what? I'm just going to go back. This is, hey, Constant listeners, this is Michael Monroeville Mall Rothman.
There you go.
Aww.
This is my comfort zone. This is why I know, now I know why you chose Rockin' Randall. Because it's
easy. it's just nice and simple.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, Mike, you own this on DVD.
I do own this on DVD. I actually watched this live when it premiered because I was just a young college grad. Well, I wasn't actually a college grad yet. I was a college student in Tallahassee, Florida, where I met Dan Caffrey, fellow loser. And actually, Mac, too. But I was watching it live when it went down, and I hadn't read
when
any
it went down.
When it went down, and I only recognized like a few of the stories because obviously I hadn't read Nightmares and Dreamscapes at that point. And it's mid-aughts television. This is before we got the second wave with Mad Men and Breaking Bad and all the other great shows that we know now. And so I didn't think much of it. You know, it was the middle of the summer, so it was kind of like, all right, well, whatever, great, this is fine. This is okay television. And then when I got the DVD for our huge ranking for Stephen King sometime in, I think it was, 2017 when it came out, I rewatched them all and just cowered at the CGI and why some of these actors. I was just embarrassed for some of the actors in this too. And I got really depressed for Ron Livingston because this is like pre-Conjuring. So I'm like, oh man, he's really roughing it here. But anyway, yeah. So I got some, you would say, mixed feelings for this series. But yeah.
All right.
That's my story.
Well, we'll talk more about all of that shortly. And who is joining us from Nashville?
Hi, this is Jen Ahoochie Mama Adams from Nashville. And an example of the early aughts dialogue, which
Yeah.
I did not know this existed until a couple of weeks ago.
Oh wow.
I know. Yeah. Which, okay. So I think I was in my phase. I think a lot of King fans, sometimes you grow up obsessed with it. And then like I went to college and like heard people like kind of shaming Stephen King. So I kind of was out of him for a little bit. And then I kind of, my fandom came back with like full force. And I think this must have been in that period because it would have been totally on my radar. And I just don't remember it existing at all, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and this is Rockin' Randall Colburn, and I remember barely hearing about this, but I didn't have cable at the time, and I remember seeing previews, and it didn't really, like, I liked King at the time, but I wasn't, like, deep in it, and I also just looked, I saw the previews, and I was like, I don't know about that, so I never really sought it out, although it's always been an interesting sort of curio for me, and also I heard from, you know, the people who had watched it that it wasn't that great, so this was my first full viewing. I had seen Battleground when we did Night Shift, because we talked about that adaptation back then. And we'll probably touch on it a little bit more here because I think it's sort of the crown jewel of this series.
Oh, easily.
Which is why they did it first. but before we talk about it, let's go through just kind of some more details of it. So it aired July 12th through August 2nd, 2006. A DVD came out with many special features that Mike watched all of. We're going to talk about those as well in October 2006. And the episodes, there's 8 episodes, and they were based on the Nightmares and Dreamscape stories, Omni's Last Case, You Know They Got a Hell of a Band, The End of the Whole Mess, The Fifth Quarter, and Crouch End. We won't be reviewing those stories necessarily. We'll be talking about them next week in our first episode of our Nightmares and Dreamscapes series. Well, maybe we'll talk about some of them then, and then some of them in the week after that, because we go from worst to best, so be prepared for that. And then there's also adaptations of 2 Everything's Eventual stories, The Road Virus Heads North and Autopsy Room 4, and then Battleground from Night Shift, which was what they kicked it all off with. And there was kind of a, you know, pretty big names associated with this.
Yeah.
I think William Hurt specifically in Battleground was a big deal. He's always been, you know, a bankable star, money in the bank, as you like to say. You know, you can't go wrong with William Hurt. So, So I think getting him, and he didn't do a lot of TV, especially back then, so that was a pretty big get for them. But, you know, there was also the great Tom Berenger, William H. Macy, which was probably, to me, the most impressive get. And then Ron Livingston from Office Space, obviously, and now the Conjuring franchise. The great Steven Weber, you may remember from the Shining miniseries, also the also the person who reads the It audiobook, I believe. Is it It or is it The Shining? I think it's It.
It's It, yeah. And Wings. He's super dreamy on Wings.
Oh, yeah. You always got Wings.
I love Steven Weber.
Yeah. Kim Delaney, Samantha Mathis, and then perhaps maybe one of the most beautiful women who has ever walked this earth, Claire Forlani from Mallrats.
Yeah.
Always felt she was a bit above Mallrats, but, you know, still a great film. And I think sort of in maybe the best bit of casting, Savage Commando from Battleground was played by Bill Beretta, who was kind of a staple of the Henson, Jim Henson universe. And we'll talk about the Henson Creature Shop ties shortly. So a couple fun things about this was it's not really remembered as being sort of a great televisual event. There was never a second season. There was never really a lot of chatter about it. But this was nominated for several Emmy Awards. So it was nominated for, let me see here, Makeup for a Miniseries, Non-Prosthetic, which makes sense because that's the Henson stuff. Music Composition. Oh boy, do I have some.
Yeah, that's a
do
problem.
I have some thoughts on this. Original Dramatic Score was up for an Emmy. And then William H. Macy was up for Lead Actor in a Miniseries or a Movie for his role in Umney's Last Case.
Really?
You know, yeah, I have thoughts on that too.
I got some defense for that. So,
we'll get to it.
Yeah.
We'll get to it. And the ratings were actually quite good, at least in the first week. It debuted. Its back-to-back episodes debuted number one and number two in basic cable for the night, which was a pretty big deal. And it drew, the first installment, Battleground, drew 5.2 million total viewers. And then, what was it? Second one, Crouch End, reached 4.8 million people. That's a lot. Like, they would kill for those numbers today.
Well, it's kind of crazy, too, because if you look at, like, what was in theaters at the time, and it's not like they had a pandemic or anything to keep everyone at home, it was going up against some big movies that summer. I mean, you had, like, Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, Dead Man's Chest, Devil Wears Prada, I guess after that was kind of a dead zone with My Super Ex-Girlfriend in Monster House. But, I mean, you know, to be that mid-season of the summer, to do well numbers wise is pretty staggering. Kind of an accomplishment, you know, looking in hindsight. But yeah, I'm a little shocked at some of these critical awards.
Yeah, so yeah. I looked on Rotten Tomatoes and I saw that it had an 88% fresh rating. And again, you can't really trust Rotten Tomatoes because it doesn't really account for, it's like everything's either an A or an F, right? When you're looking at Rotten Tomatoes. Yeah. But even looking at a lot of the reviews, it was very positive. But I think, and from what I was looking at, most of the reviews were for the first episode, for Battleground, which is by far the most impressive episode. So I can see where a lot of that comes from. A few of them did dig a little bit deeper. The New York Times gave it overall a positive review, but it was an incredibly condescending one. New York Times always had sort of a chip on its shoulder from just having dug into reviews and for this podcast. I've always noticed they've had a bit of chip on their shoulder when it comes to Stephen King. A New York Times review begins, "Stephen King has no end of bankable nightmares, the surreal Farrago kind in which the cursor turns into your father, who is also Jack Kennedy, and he keeps slipping into the pool. What's so great about that? Like all of our boring dreams, Mr. King's don't cohere. They're desultory and plotless. Characters come and go, and dialogue, it sounds pithy, is also meaningless." That's how the beginning of this positive review begins. They go on to say, "The series is an excellent reminder that what makes Mr. King's vision so fascinating is not their uniqueness or their artistry, but exactly how much they're like ordinary nightmares." So even the praise is condescending. But they do Overall gave it a positive review. Same with Boston.com, which were more negative, but I was intrigued. I thought this was actually at least a little more intriguing. They say, it's a mixed bag that never quite moves beyond non-sequitur creeps and special effects. The production values are sleek, and with casts that include Jeremy Sisto, the great Jeremy Sisto, you might say.
Clueless Jeremy Sisto.
Hideaway.
Stephen Weber, Rod Livingston, and Marsha Mason. The acting is solid enough, but many of the stories fail to transcend their own narrative details towards something universal. But then even that review, along with several of the other ones, praised Battleground as sort of being the best one. But you know, I was looking the Austin Chronicle, Washington Post, a lot of places like that gave this very, very good reviews. So
I think it's because of the episodes they gave. I mean, I think Crouch's End is awful. And that's only one of the three that they gave. It looks like Umneys and also Battleground were rounded out the three that they got, which, hey, I mean, if I got Umneys and Battleground, I see that this is a summer Stephen King fiesta, and it's also in the mid-aughts when television doesn't have too much of a watermark for expectations outside of HBO. I'd probably give it a mid-level positive review. I don't know if I'd go all in as to an 80% or something like that, like Rotten Tomatoes gives it, but I guess I could see myself pulling punches like the New York Times does in the review. But
So I found that very interesting. But I think you're right, Mike. I think it just really speaks to kind of maybe the state of television during that time. I mean, obviously you had the Sopranos going on HBO, but you also had sort of like the Shield was doing its thing around that time. But like the cable drama was still finding itself,
exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like Lost was a big phenomenon and things like that. But it's like, in terms of TV horror, there really weren't a lot of, watermarks. There weren't really a lot of people who were doing it well at that time. I mean, if you want to say Walking Dead, at least the first season was solid, you know, but it's like, that was still a few years off.
Oh, totally.
Several years off. So
I mean, it wasn't until 2008, I would give it maybe 2009 when you start seeing things coalesce a little bit more outside of, you know, the HBOs and the Showtimes. And I mean, even looking back at some of the Showtime shows around this time, especially with like Dexter, it's not that great. Like, I mean, it's still kind of finding its footing. So,
oh yeah, I forgot about Dexter.
With the exception of like, you know, The Sopranos and Oz and like The Wire, you're not going to get like, you don't really get great television. I mean, the exception of obviously The Shield that you mentioned. And I actually think the first three seasons of Rescue Me are pretty phenomenal. But again, it was like budding television at that point. So
And TNT, you know, they're not known for this kind of TV. And I think that they had done the Salem's Lot adaptation, the Rob Lowe one a few years previous. And I think that this
they did
and
Rose
I think
Red too, right?
Oh yeah, Rose Red, and that was. God, that wasn't that in the '90s.
I just looked it up. I think it's 2002.
Yeah, it's like early 2000s. Like, I have that on DVD still, and I don't know. I haven't watched it.
Well, I'll just say this: like, Rose Red is trash. Like, it is really, really bad. I have lots of thoughts on it, which we'll talk about when we get there. But, but there's that. But then, and then the Rob Lowe Salem's Lot, I think, is better than it maybe. Could have been, but it's still not great. But it did really, really well for the network. So I
Which
think
is
that's
funny.
Why they
like they say they mentioned that in the New York Times. They're like, you know, these elaborate show-off productions, which star people like William H. Macy and William Hurt, are proof that TNT, having had success with Salem's Lot in 2004, is really getting into the movie-making game. Like,
which is funny now, right?
Yeah, like nobody talks about Salem's Lot. Like they,
right. Well, I think back then, you know, TV was still not the respected property it is today. And so I think just the fact that there was any production value, you know, it's like that they weren't just shooting on unit sets or whatever. It was they were actually trying to make something cinematic. Like, even though it looks really chintzy from our point of view today, I think that, and especially many of these episodes do, it's almost shocking. But it's like, it's, you know, I think at that time it was at least considered a solid effort. And so, so I think like, let's maybe just begin by talking about Battleground, because I think maybe we'd all agree that that was probably the best one.
Definitely my favorite.
Yeah. And I think, and then we'll talk about kind of the mixed bag that is the rest of them. But you know, and there was a lot of press that went into Battleground because it was, you know, it was created where they basically recruited Brian Henson of the Jim Henson Company, the Creature Shop, to direct the episode and also create the effects for it. And they didn't really rely on CGI like they do in a lot of the rest of the series to do this. So the effects actually look pretty cool. Like the little army men actually have like a really strong aesthetic. They look really neat. And even some of the gore effects are kind of fun, you know? So, yeah. But what else did you guys think about Battleground?
Well, I think what really works for it is the fact that it is silent, and there's an artistic choice with that, you know, and the fact that there are no words that are spoken other than, you know, from at least William Hurt's standpoint, and I think that helps in giving it you don't have the cheesy dialogue that you have in the other chapters here.
Right, the dialogue is so bad.
There's an irony to that though, because if there's anyone that's going to be able to take dialogue and elevate it in this entire cast, I mean, granted, it should be all of them considering that we have pretty much B plus level talent here, if not A minus talent. William Hurt, like he'd be able to make any script really shitty. I mean, for Christ's sake, he made like the ending of AI sound good. So I just think like he probably could have done really well with some of the dialogue, but at the same time, like I love his little like physical quirks here. There's a great bit in Stella. With you know, Michael Ian Black and Michael Showalter and David Wayne, and in Comedy Central, it was like one season. But they do charades, and at one point they're like, they're like, oh, do your William Hurt or whatever, and all of a sudden he just goes quiet and he like does a weird smirk and tilts his head, and like that's his impersonation.
I think that is interesting. I realize that I assume most of our listeners probably know what Battleground's about, but it would probably be helpful just to say, basically it's about a hitman who comes home and somebody's delivered a package for him, and he opens it, and it's a bunch of little toy soldiers who begin attacking him, and that sounds funny. You know, on its face, but then all the little bullets and all the little things eventually add up, and soon let's just say that he loses the war. Yeah. So I like that you bring up the idea of kind of showing off William Hurt as a physical actor, which is something we don't really get. I mean, he's the kind of guy you rely on when you need sort of a steady emotional hand and somebody to, I don't know, bring gravitas. And he brings that gravitas, but I do kind of like love to think about an alternate universe in which you had like a physical, like an actor who's known for physical comedy. Like the first person that came to mind, which is funny, but I just wrote about him recently, but Toby Huss, who played Artie, the strongest man in the world, in Pete and Pete. And he's like now kind of a really reliable character actor who pops up and stuff all the time. But he's such like an elastic, fun, like weird physical actor. I'd love to see somebody like that, like do this kind of, I don't know, completely silent play that this is.
I could see him doing it easily. I mean, for him, I think it would probably be, you know, second nature just because he is so physical. But I applaud Hurt in being an action man here because he's not really one. I mean, there's like, I'm trying to think like what movies of his catalog could even be construed as like action. He's not, like, he's a dramatic actor. So like to have him in this like total macho actiony role is not only against type, which probably is why he did it, because it seemed challenging to him at the time, but I don't know. He's just intriguing to watch. And I should note that the producers of this were probably huge fans of The Big Chill, considering that Tom Berenger is also in this series. So you have Berenger, you know, and Hurt both together. It's a shame they couldn't reunite because they are kind of rivals in The Big Chill. So it would have been funny to, as a spiritual nod there. But love Battleground. And what I love about it also is that there's this sort of seclusion to it too, that kind of reminds me of like Creepshow and Cat's Eye. Like Creepshow with you know, the cockroach segment, where it's seemingly assumed that like it just feels like there's nobody in New York City during that rainy night for the guy when all the cockroaches are getting him. And then also when you look at The Ledge for Cat's Eye, there's this sort of like almost like quasi dystopian quality to that story, where like he's kind of alone on this ledge like, how is this outlandish thing happening in the midst of a major metropolis? And I kind of like that with this. There, it kind of harkens back to the simplicity of that seclusion with those chapters. So, and which is fitting because they all seem to they all come from they're all cut from the same cloth of Stephen King's source material. So I love that about it. But
yeah, it's very contained, and it's like a one man bottle episode, which I think some of the other ones struggle because I think they're trying to do too much with the story in such a small amount of time. And this one, you don't, he doesn't have to interact with anybody else. Like there's no dialogue. It was really well done. The gore actually really affected me and kind of made me sick. And in my notes, I was like, wow, this is really, like, I was not expecting it to be as good as it was right off the bat, because I kind of saw the opening scene and I was like, oh boy. But I just thought I was really into this, and I don't love this story. So I feel like this, like, it brought it alive in a way that I was really excited about.
That's cool. Yeah. Fun fact. Do you guys know who wrote this episode?
Oh, yes. Richard Matheson's son.
Christian Matheson, which I think is a really cool kind of maybe full circle moment for Stephen King, because, you know, he loved Richard Matheson so much, and I think it's, you know, obviously really cool for him to give an opportunity to Matheson's son, who's also a very, you know, celebrated author in his own right. So
there's a trivia part in IMDb where it says that King went to Matheson's grave and he said, looks like I got your son working for me, you son of a bitch. No,
I wish
joking.
That was true. I was with you happened. So far into that. So that's amazing. So yeah, I think like we can all agree, and I think that's why, you know, why they front loaded the screeners that they sent to the critics with this one. But you know, I think Crouch End, I have some interesting thoughts on, and then Omni. Let's move into that, because Mike, I want to hear your defense of Omni's Last Case, because if I'm being honest, I found it unwatchable.
So again, it you have to.
Wait, let's say what it's about first. Why don't you explain that, and then you break down why you like it.
Well, I mean, it's kind of like John Candy's Delirious, in which the writer, you know, suffering from writer's block, finds himself into his own little story, and he gets to be the kind of lead main character. It's a fantasy for all writers, which, so you could tell that, you know, King kind of gets to live out again the sort of inside baseball he knows as a writer. But you know, it's a throwback vintage film noir style story, which I think really works to William H. Macy's favor, because I'm always just going to think of him as this old fashioned actor. Like it's not just because of Pleasantville. I almost like mix Fargo in this as well, where he just seems like he's from a different era to me. So that kind of worked to the benefit of this segment for me. I always just see Macy as just kind of like, you look at old photos sometimes, right? And like from the 1800s and like the early 1900s. And you go like, wow, those people really don't look anything like the people today. Like they all have like different sharper features. And a lot of that is because of the cameras that, and the ways that the portraits are presented. But there are people that just look like they're from a different era, and like Macy's one of them. And so for me, that coupled with the sort of tongue-in-cheek tone of it all, and it being kind of like a almost like a summer stock thing, like I just loved it. Like love is too hard of a thing, but I find it okay, and I think it's just sprightly King, if that makes any sense. like it's charming in a way, and I credit all that solely to William H. Macy, who's never done a bad thing in his life, including tuition scandals. Yeah.
It was all Felicity, right?
yeah
he had nothing to do with it.
Yeah, he had nothing. That's absolutely nothing at all. But yeah, so for me, that's why it works. But I also can see the arguments for why it's like cheesy as hell and chintzy as hell. And maybe the production quality isn't the greatest, because to be fair, with the exception of Battleground, which even still has some sort of PS2 graphics to it, the production quality of this show is not good.
No.
In the slightest. So.
Yeah. I didn't really mind. Like, I kind of liked the two William H. Macy's. And I think the my favorite part of this was when they were interacting and he was like asking him questions about his life and saying, you don't know because I haven't wrote it. I really liked that. But what was so, and I swear I have read this story, but I remembered basically nothing about it. So then all of a sudden when they were talking about this child drowning in the pool, I was like, where did that come from? If with this like lighthearted story. And I think that was the hardest part for me. One, like that's, those are just hard things for me to watch. But it just, like the dichotomy of those two tones just felt really off, you know?
Yeah.
And I just, I couldn't ever like, I thought we were watching this fun noir. And I think I would have liked it better if it had been more about the two of them just interacting with each other, you know? But it, no. I think it just tried too much, you know?
I agree. I mean, honestly, that's one of the reasons. That's one of the things I have, that's one of the struggles I have with the new Twilight Zone. My mind just kind of circling all into that, and by the time this episode drops, the review's already out, so whatever, the embargo is already lifted. So, I mean, it's just all over the place, and the problem is that I think that, and I talked a little bit about this on The Fifth Dimension last year, but I think that to write, like, really good, solid anthological television, I think some of the reasons why like the Twilight Zone of like, you know, the 50s and 60s were so great, as opposed to something like, say, like even in the 90s and the 2000s when you get into anthology television, is that you have writers that are not so gluttonous. They really mm-hmm. have to kind of treat the every word and every sheet of paper with the respect it deserves, and knowing that, like, you know, every line is pretty much like almost like a lifeline, almost like you really have to keep this going and everything has to count. And like, as we start getting into like the more exaggerated you know, run times where it's like, you know, where it goes from 22 minutes and 30 minutes to like 45 minutes and 50 minutes, like you get a little bit more freedom, and I think that freedom kind of ruins the story. And it also has conditioned a lot of the more modern writers to write in this medium to kind of be a little more lazy and not so terse. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the problem I have with both seasons of The Twilight Zone so far, is that like there's just too much. Like, you don't need that much. And in these segments, like, less is more. And that's one of the reasons mm-hmm. why so many of the Twilight Zone episodes of yesteryear are so impactful, because you really only have the bare bones story, but man, that the bare bones story allows the emotional twist to hit so hard. And I think that's kind of what happens with this one too, is that like they try to include absolutely. Too much with the short story when you really only needed the bare bones of it for it to work.
Yeah, this series is very much hobbled by the run times. I think that almost every episode is too long. But at the same time, it feels like they're still trying to do too much. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So the pacing is always off. The story is always cluttered. There's horror set pieces that are clearly there just for the sake of being set pieces. I have a thought on Crouch End in a moment. But it's like, I think the other problem too is like, I think maybe Nightmares and Dreamscapes downfall is sort of also one of its strengths, which is that it tried to show all these different sides of King's work. Like, I mean, the idea of doing Omni's Last Case and being like, hey, we're going to show this noirish side of King, you know, that a lot of people don't get to see very often. I think that's a great idea. But the problem is, like, not just anybody can direct that kind of stuff. And I'm looking at the resume of the guy who directed that episode. His name's Rob Bowman, very prolific director, directed for basically every TV show around, including, like, many, many, many episodes of The X-Files.
Oh,
and also 12 episodes of Parker Lewis Can't Lose, King's Dominion, Corin Nemec. So
Supernatural star Corin Nemec.
But also just like look at that difference. X-Files, Parker Lewis Can't Lose. He also directed the films Reign of Fire and Elektra, and both of those did not do well. So he was actually licking his wounds that when he was directing his episodes of Nightmares and Dreamscapes, which were was one of the first things he directed after those movies flopped. So I think, but the idea that this guy who is clearly an everyman, like, because I'm looking at his resume, he directed on like everything. Mm-hmm. And he directed horror, he directed sci-fi, he directed drama, he directed comedy. And that's probably why they liked him, that it seemed like he could do it all. But the way that I mm-hmm. see it is he doesn't really have a clear vision. And mm-hmm. he's playing with noir tropes and ideas of what noir is, and like that fast talking kind of like, you know, mm-hmm. kind of bullshit. And
get a job, see?
Yeah. And I don't like, that's what kind of killed me for it. Was like, I was watching somebody sort of play acting their memories of what, you know, of a paperback pulp dime store novel that they read when they were young, you know?
Randall, yeah. you're forgetting one thing, and this is very important to Randall and I, because it's literally, we're like pretty much the only diehard fans of this movie in the entire world. I might agree with you that Rob Bowman doesn't have a vision. For all considerations based on his resume, he doesn't. But we would be forgetting one film.
I just saw it.
1993 action comedy drama about inline skating features a Shane McDermott, real estate agent Shane McDermott, Seth Green, Brittany Powell,
and Jack Black.
Jack Black, and my former teacher, Chris Conrad, Airborne.
If that is not Airborne. A vision.
I totally missed Airborne when I was looking through his through his thing. So, well, I will say
I had such a crush on Seth Green in that movie.
I will say this. The best part of Airborne is not the directing. It is the performance by the real estate agent.
Yeah.
By AKA the kid who plays the lead character, who is now a real estate agent.
Yeah.
He is so hysterically funny in that movie. Highly recommend Airborne. Maybe we'll start Airborne Cast.
That'd join be great.
Casper Cast. So Casper Van Cast.
Had to throw that out there. Sorry for interrupting, but I just kind of did a
no. I'm glad you pointed that out. So anyways, I guess that's my thing, is like, I don't feel like I'm in good hands with somebody directing something that is that highly stylized. Mm-hmm. And so I don't feel like we're getting sort of a good adaptation of Omni's unwatchable Last Case. Jen, any other thoughts on Omni's Last Case?
Not necessarily on Omni's, but just like the whole thing has, like, you know, when you're watching a biopic and it's like, they're just filming the Wikipedia page.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got that feeling. It's like, they're just going through beat by beat by beat of these stories, and there's no life to it, you know? And,
mm-hmm.
and I agree that I like that they showed such a wide range, but it's just like, it always just feels like filming a storyboard of all of these, like, put together, you know. It just,
yeah,
I don't know.
Well, what's is Never. There one that is there one that stands out to you that you actually like besides Battleground?
Yeah, I did really like The Road Virus Heads North. I was okay. into that one, and I love that story, so I was excited to see that. Of course, I love most of these stories, and when I was reading all of the titles, I got really, really excited, and then really sad pretty soon after. But yeah, I thought Tom Berenger was good. I thought the picture kind of creeped me out. Now, it did get a little cheesy. I didn't like the cancer subplot, I don't think is in the story. And I think that's an example of trying to put more in than it needed. And I don't know if it was to fill run times, which is probably what that crystal healing thing was about. But
that was
I do
weird.
Really
is that
like,
not in the story?
No, it's not in the story. Yeah, they talk about the ex-wife, like... They talk about her being into it, but she's not a character in the story. Like, they just talk about her. And that's a really great story. And I like, this was very faithful to it, but it just, I did like that. Mostly because the imagery of the Road Virus, I think, was creepy, you know?
I have a question based on the Road Virus. How many bottles of Jack Daniels do you think Tom Berenger drank before and after every take? I mean,
he is a little red faced.
It is just unfucking real in this segment. I mean, granted, you watch like Inception, he looks like he's literally like sipping a flask every between takes. But like, and this is coming from someone who loves Berenger. Don't get me wrong. Like, mm-hmm. you know, Jake Taylor.
I thought he was
one
good
of my favorite characters.
In this short. Yeah,
he's not bad in this. But it just looks as if like, I don't know. Maybe that's not fair, but.
Yeah. His knees are still hurting, you know, he's got to dull that pain.
Yeah. He's probably sitting there just being like, God, I wish I would have won that World Series.
I know.
God. I just wanted them to just say, because the way that the character in the painting in Road Virus was designed, I wanted them to say that it was just Randall Flagg.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not how I pictured him when I read. I pictured him with shorter hair. Although I did like that they did the cannibal teeth, which is something King mentions a couple of times in different stuff that I liked.
Yeah, I feel like there was just, I feel like, and this is in that episode, but then also in a lot of these was, and I think this was just like a filming like trend at the time, or at least like a shot trend was, it was very Rob Zombie music video to me. It was like jagged cuts and it was, you know, and like weird zooms and like weird filters that were being used on everything. And like this shaky sort of jagged quick cut kind of thing. And I found that, it felt like I was just watching like a metal music video sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, it's weird. And I think, go for it. No, you go.
This might have been an example of me just loving the story so much and really wanting it to be good and like kind of transferring a little bit of that love into it and kind of giving it a lot more credit than it probably deserves. Because there were a couple of other ones that I kind of did that with.
Yeah, I would say that Red Virus was one of my favorites out of them. Another one that I thought wasn't too bad. I mean, I think it was like way overstuffed and I might get laughs at this, but I didn't hate, you know, they got a hell of a band.
Oh God. Are you fucking kidding me? That is,
I disagree on that. Oof.
Well, yeah. Okay. This is a bigger question. And I think the reason I liked it is because it felt like they were trying to tap into the sillier side of King. Like, and I think that's something that a lot of people have basically almost nobody's figured out how to do, because there is this sort of goofy side to King, and the thing is his movies and his shows and everything, they always play well when you kind of double down on the darkness and the nastiness and the character work, you know, like, or the good dramatic character work. But I do feel like there's just these stories, like, that's such an inherently dumb story. So how else are you supposed to play it? And I actually gave it a little bit of credit for sort of making it really stupid. Like, I think that they really doubled down on the way they played Elvis, like the way
they
that,
totally do. Yeah.
Yeah. You're like, yeah. And I guess I just appreciated that because I'm like, well, how else do you do this thing?
No, you can't. I mean, Weber,
well, with the budget they had.
Well, one of the things I was going to mention with the special features I watch is that, like, you know, every segment has interviews with the cast and crew. And they're, you know, this is, I don't know why they didn't have like a digital camera, but like it literally looks like they're like filming from like a late 90s camcorder for most of them. And the my favorite one is with Weber, who I just love Weber in general, and he was great.
I think he's good in it too.
In Curb Enthusiasm, he's amazing. But I love Weber, but in his interview, he takes these long pauses as if he's like trying to like, you know, as if he's like walking on thin ice, because like I feel like he's in on the joke, like he knows that this is fucking stupid. And throughout the whole, like, they're interviewing him outside the diner, and he's like, you know, I think the real joy with this is that you know, they find some reality despite this being you know, a pretty outlandish story. And he like leaves it at that. And But he has the way that he does these pauses, and he's like, you know, I just love Stephen King, and I guess because I was in The Shining, I'm, you know, connected. But it's so like he's being respectful and reverent of King's work, but he just knows that like it's like someone telling the worst best kept secret. And like, and I love his reaction in this, because I think it does feed into what you're saying, Randall, on that, like, they do know that there is a self awareness to this that gets, you know, that gets through. Having said that, the special effects in this are like literally on par with the Vegas sequence in the Stan miniseries.
The Hand of God.
When Janis Joplin is singing, I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
It reminds me of like Beetlejuice's like Graveyard Review, like from like Universal Studios, like a bunch of extras that just like dress up as these stars that have no idea who they're playing, but they're like, oh yeah, I'm wearing, you know, the wardrobe from Jimi Hendrix, and I'm Jimi Hendrix. Like,
Say that I think the reason I liked this one was because I at least didn't find it boring.
No.
Whereas I thought a lot of them were just really boring. Like the fifth quarter with Jeremy Sisto, I thought was like painfully dull.
Yeah.
Yeah. that was one that I could not wait to be over, you know? And so, yeah, I guess you're right. Like, at least I was kind of into, you know, they got a hell of a band just because of the bonkersness, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
And how many times can he not listen to her when she says she wants to leave?
I know. And like, there were so many weird, like when they went back to the town after like Elvis pulled them over or whatever, like mm-hmm. it was like Weber was playing a different, like he thought they were filming something earlier because there's uh-huh. clearly a sense of menace and he was like excited for the concert. I'm like, what the fuck?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. He's just a fantastic actor,
you know?
I kind of would couple that, though, with Autopsy Room 4.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that you could have taken a more serious approach with this, and because it is like a pretty high stakes story when you think about it, and it's kind of a classic Edgar Allan Poe style story. Mm-hmm. From King, in which, you know, someone's on the operating table, they've been bitten by a snake, they're paralyzed, it's almost like the Romeo and Juliet sort of ending, and you know, he's still alive but they think he's dead, even though this is modern science, so I don't know how that slips through, but you know, either way, you buy the bit. But it's very tongue-in-cheek in the same way that you know, they got a hell of a band. And look, I love seeing my boy Richard Thomas. And if there's anyone mm-hmm. that's happy to see him, I know it's you, Randall, also, because...
Oh, I love him, yeah.
Like mm-hmm. Airborne, we love Richard Thomas. We're huge Richard Thomas fans. Wanted him to be in It Chapter 2. I think we joked around saying that we would have wanted him just to come back as Bill or something.
Just play Bill again.
But and I think he does a good job here. I mean, he kind of plays this sort of like... George Bush supporter, almost like the way he's just so like he plays like this suburban white guy like so well in this. I don't know, I found it fun. It's not good in any way, shape or form, mm-hmm. but it's again self-aware, and that self-awareness goes a long way. I almost wish all of these were self-aware, because I feel like they would have passed under the radar a little bit more. But good God, when they get mm-hmm. serious, this show is awful.
Right. And I think that is a good place to bring us to Crouch End, which I think it's a story that I like. And it's, you know, and I will say that I know at least some of our panel is a fan of that story. And, you know, and it's another shade of King, which is like Lovecraft King, right? It's like mm-hmm. this couple, this American couple is in London, and then they're directed to this neighborhood called Crouch End that some cabbies won't take them to. And then when one is taken, they say, oh, it was built on a druid burial ground. And, you know, and then they start seeing all this weird, spooky stuff, which we'll talk more about in a second because it's very funny. But but it's, you know, and then it's... basically they realize that they have stumbled into kind of a rip in the fabric of the universe, and creatures from the other dimensions. There's a lot of direct Lovecraft references. There's references to Cthulhu, and then also Yag-Sothoth, I'm probably saying that wrong, and all the other Lovecraft things, monsters. And so it's very, you know, it's very pointed in that sense. And I actually was quite excited for it when it started, although mm-hmm. it gets off to kind of a bad start in just the general, like it's very much a King trope where like two people, like a married couple, are together and all they can do is paw at each other and just be like, I want to fuck, we have to fuck, like every, like the first 10 minutes is just endless of that. It's just like, I get it, you're in love, you know? And and so it's very funny to me. And so but then when they get to Crouch End, we start to see, I don't know, they try to be scary and it's not really scary. And this is where I was talking about sort of horror set pieces for the sake of it. There's kind of a whole section where he gets pulled into a hedge and gets like tossed about and mussed about a little bit. And it's just, and then he comes out and he's like, I don't know what happened. And that to me is like very frustrating, because mm-hmm. I'm like, no, you were attacked by a monster or something, and we have no idea what it was. There's no clue as to what it was. It was just a scary thing that happened for the sake of it, because they needed it to happen in that moment, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it drove
this
me nuts.
Is one that I feel like is really, really does a disservice to the story by trying to stick as close to the story as it does, you know? Like, this could be an example to, or a way, or huh, this could be one where you could really explore like the different atmospheres, because what makes that story successful, and it is one of my favorite short stories, is how creepy it is and how creepy the atmosphere is. And don't necessarily have to do that with those two kids and the cat. You can do it in another way and be like creative with it. And they just didn't. They were so like slavish to the story that I think it just didn't, it didn't work at all. And this is an example of King writing things that do not translate well to the screen. And it was funny because I was just talking in our Bag of Bones episode that this is what I would want Creepshow to do.
Yeah.
And now I'm like, well, maybe not. But I do want to say, like, the audiobook of this is amazing, and Tim Curry reads it.
It's
so
King's
creepy,
Dominion.
And it, I just love it. And so that's part of the reason I love this story, and this was the one I was the most excited for, and this was, like, my journey to being let down was the hardest in this one.
But again, I think a lot of it happens to
But
I think a lot of it happens to be with the, like the lack of vision, like what you're saying with Rob Bowman.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy, Mark Harbert, or Mark Haber, he's, I mean, up to that point, he had only done TV movies like Daisies in December, that classic 1995 winner. And then,
oh, that's my
you know,
favorite.
Like Alien Cargo or Dying to Dance. And like, he's since only done like.
And then you're going to give, and you're going to give him like a Lovecraft adaptation. You know what I mean? Like, you're going to give him something this ambitious. Like, this is a really complex story. I mean, this is like, you're dealing with like unspeakably evil monsters in this. And like, that's the thing. You need a horror director to make this, you know? And that's, I think, what drives me crazy. And also just anybody who would let that cat with the hollowed out eye, CGI eye on screen. And they kept showing it. It literally, like, it was like, it was, I don't know. It's one of the fakest effects I've ever seen in my life. And they show it like six times. And I literally wrote in my notes, stop showing the cat.
Yeah.
Stop showing the cat.
It makes David Lynch's like pointedly shitty CGI look so much like Uncanny Valley by comparison. It was so mind boggling that this was actually on primetime television at this time. I guess primetime is TNT, right? I don't know.
That they led off with this too.
Yeah, like what the fuck? And then, but then again, if you like look back, like I've been watching a lot of movies from the aughts. I don't know why, because for me it's the worst decade in terms of any culture. But we watched Spider-Man the other night, and I love Spider-Man. And but there's a scene where when he like first becomes Spider-Man, and he like crawls in the wall, and I'll tell you, I saw that movie 12 times in theaters, and I probably like lost my shit every time like you see Tobey Maguire jump on that fucking wall. But like, as a 36 year old now who's seen some great CGI, I'm like, what the fuck were they thinking? Like, this got past like major, this made $400 million. And then I'm like, just thinking, well, CGI at this time, they just went with it. They just put it on the screen because I remember complaining so many times about some of the CGI at that point. And it's just, that's why like when you see garish CGI now, it really does kind of harken back to that era where it's like, we just let things go by because, well, it was cheap and easy. And we still were kind of in that ooh and ah phase of like things that were coming, you know, that were digitally made. I mean, like you look back at like, even Gollum hasn't aged that well. I mean, people still praise the Lord of the Rings movies, but I recently watched that movie. One of them, I can't remember which ones. I don't really know him that well, but like he's, you know, he's walking around like talking to Frodo, and I'm like, I gotta be honest with you. They're gonna have to George Lucas this and fix the CGI in it, because it doesn't look too great. It's just, I just don't think the aughts were good with CGI.
It almost makes me wonder if they blew their whole budget on Battleground.
Yeah,
they probably
have. But you don't have to make the eye the creepy thing about the cat,
right?
You know, like you could make like that was a choice they made because they wanted to stay faithful to the story, and like that blows it. You don't have like give a flicker of his face changing into like a goat or something.
Yeah,
or, like just make it a mean looking cat. You know, like
I agree.
Yeah.
I mean, like, they did the Sleepwalker's face with those biker boys or whatever. Like,
right. Do that.
Make the cat have a human face, you know?
Ooh, right. That would be good. They should have brought Garrus in. Like, why didn't they bring Garrus? I mean.
But I'll just say that. And then you also see, like, when they see the vortex later and you see the cat fly into it. And it's just, like, a still image of the cat that's, like, moving. And it reminded me of like the mannequin Nadine falling from the balcony in the stand.
Which still looks better. Like that, even that effect somehow looks better. I always go back to like The Evil Dead and even The Evil Dead 2. Like Sam Raimi had hardly any fucking money when he made that movie. And yet the portal sequence at the end of that movie when Ash is being thrown in there, it still, I mean, obviously it looks fake and it's a blue screen, but it still looks so much more realistic than half a dozen of the shit that happens with millions upon millions of dollars. And I don't get it. I still don't get it. I still don't get why, you know, 2015's Jurassic World looks worse than 1993's Jurassic Park. Like, I don't get how these things happen.
Jen, what did you think about Jurassic World?
Yeah, please go.
Okay, unpopular opinion. I really liked it. I had a lot of fun.
So did Dan Caffrey.
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, it was like the greatest hits, you know, like going to a reunion concert. And so I just had fun with it. Now, the next one, The Lost Kingdom, was... people told me how terrible that was, and I was not prepared to hate it as much as I did, but I did really enjoy. So I like Jurassic World and I like Jurassic Park, and those are the extreme high points of that franchise.
Well,
for me,
you know, to connect this back, there was a young Jewish filmmaker by the name of Steven Spielberg who did the original one in 1993. That same year, he also did Schindler's List, but 11 years before that, he did a movie called E.T. starring Henry Thomas. And Henry Thomas would grow up to become quite a horror actor, as he's a favorite of Mike Flanagan. And I gotta say, seeing him paired with one of my favorite actors of all time, and Ron Livingston.
Ron Livingston is one of your favorite actors of all time.
I love Livingston. I love him. I love him ever since Swingers.
He's great on Sex and the City.
Yes, he is. He's great in that. Yeah, totally.
I love him, but he's nobody's favorite actor.
He is. Look, it's a different caliber. Like I look at, like, I have rankings. So like, Jane is always going to be at the top with DiCaprio, but when it comes to, like,
back, guys.
I just want my kids back. I love him. I just want him back. Give him some more roles. But when it comes to Ron Livingston, he's part of that crew that I have where I always am rooting for them. Like, I just always want them to do well. And when I see them, I feel like he picks his roles particularly well for the most part. So when I see him in things, I'm like, ooh, I'm excited. And so to see him paired with Henry Thomas, who I think is pretty selective as well, like, well, I think this might be the most disappointing chapter, the end of the whole mess of this whole bunch, because it should have
been
good.
I like their bad wigs in that one scene.
Oh, God. Just give me, like, you want to talk about boring. Like, this in the fifth quarter were two that just killed me. Like, I just, it was like, what a waste of fucking talent. That you just you kick the bucket on it. And
and I love this story too.
Yeah,
like, the end of the whole mess is really good, but it's so funny when he's talking about being like an award-winning documentary filmmaker and the documentaries they're showing are terrible.
I know,
they cut cardboard cutouts of them, and like they might as well have like speech bubbles coming out of their faces.
I was watching my laptop and I was sending him like videos of me watching it, and just the still shots of like the cameras clicking and like him at the Oscars, and it's like it looks like it was made in Microsoft Paint. Like, it looks so bad.
Right, really, like, bad. I could do that kind of documentary filmmaking.
I know, it cracked me up. Yeah, that one was just hyper dull for me, but I like the wigs. That was my favorite part.
The
was
wigs.
When you saw them in their long, long hair. Like, because they were so bad. Like, they looked like they just put, like, mops on their heads. Yeah.
I was watching the YouTube one, and you know those little corner commercials where the show is still on?
Yeah.
After that fender bender, there was a little NASCAR guy that ran out, and it said NASCAR at the bottom of the screen, but I was like, what the fuck? Is he going to go change the tire? It was such a bizarre coincidence. But it was more interesting than the entire episode.
I know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, this
just
is
so
that
dull.
One broke my heart a little bit.
I don't want to break your heart, Mike, but I've heard that Ron Livingston is not the best interview.
Oh, really?
Oh.
Yeah. That's all I'm going to say. My lips are sealed.
Maybe he goes pure Peter Gibbons and just kind of, you know, is nonchalant.
We should get Henry Thomas on the pod, though.
Oh, we should.
Yes.
Yeah. Just for kicks. I love him. Yeah. We can talk to him about this episode.
Well, we could talk about how he mirrored Jack, and if he got to talk to Nicholson.
Yeah, no, that actually
would
be really
Sleep.
Cool. But then we have to spend like 5 minutes being like, all right, tell us about the end of the whole mess.
Yeah, right. Was it a mess?
Was it a mess,
guys? Yeah.
Did Mikhail Salomon not deliver? Because this is the guy
he also directed Autopsy Room 4.
Yeah, and he also did Band of Brothers and Salem's Lot, and he earned like two
also
Academy Award
nods.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, out of all the filmmakers that are doing stuff on here, he probably is the most acclaimed, which is why it's so baffling that they had the tools and the talent to make the end of the whole mess not a mess, and yet it turns out to be a catastrophe. So, oh well.
Oh well. Yeah, well, I'd say that that covers most of the stories. I don't think we even talk about Fifth Quarter. It's so boring. Ugh. It's so boring. And that's, and let me just say, not a favorite of the Nightmares and Dreamscapes crew as well. Speaking of, we are back next week with the first part. It's epic. We've already recorded it. It's going to be the our least favorite stories in Nightmares and Dreamscapes. We got a great panel lined up for that. And then 2 weeks after that, we're going to have their favorite stories. And let's just say that nobody really agreed on the best and worst stories. So I think that it's, they're going to be very spirited conversations. So yeah. Anything, any final thoughts to wrap up this episode, guys?
Keep Maine Green, send money.
Yeah.
I just like seeing those little nods.
I just want to say I'm all for the idea of an Airborne cast. I've already seen a bunch of comments on our Patreon, so very supportive of our Abyss cast. If we want to do, I still haven't decided if we're going to do the director's cut or the theatrical cut. If we do indulge in that, but hopefully the theatrical cut, because the director's cut of the Abyss is kind of abysmal. But no pun
intended. That's what I watched.
And I will say, I'm all for an Airborne cast. You want to hear Randall and I just pop ollies all day and do 360s on this movie? It would be amazing.
Airborne cast for me would just be like, just to read the script. Like, that's all you need. It's the funniest fucking shit I've ever heard.
I know. It's so ridiculous.
Seth Green. That's when I fell in love with Seth Green.
Yes. Well, this is
maybe
we'll
all go down the devil's backbone together. Do nonstop references.
This was fun. A fun little precursor to our episodes on the book. Look forward to those. And we're also going to have an episode after we talk about the books, touching on the Night Flyer and Dolan's Cadillac, and maybe a few other of the Dollar Babies. We'll see. But we're going to definitely focus on those. So stay tuned. And shall we wrap it up?
I think
long
so.
Days.
Long
and
days
long
and
days.
Pleasant
nights.
Thanks, y'all. I got some hot friends. 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 But you know you want somebody to treat you good.
This is the end of our show. For now. We hope you enjoyed this production. If you like our programming, consider searching for other Bloody Disgusting podcasts, such as Creepy, Horror Queers, The Boo Crew, SCP Archives, Nightlight, Margaret's Garden, and more.